Hey guys, it's me, Camille.
And me, Tim.
And on today's show, we're tackling a topic that seems to be ever-present whenever St. Louis comes up, the intense racial segregation here.
And look, we know that our city is not alone in this, and that in many communities, people who look different live in different places.
Yeah, like where I grew up in Michigan, Black people mainly lived in what we call South Park. Most white people, they live on the North End.
Here in St. Louis, the geographic boundaries are flipped. Black people are concentrated in the northern half of the city and whites in the southern part of the city.
There's mingling around the middle and edges, of course, but not that much.
But it wasn't always this way.
Certainly not when Christine Smize was growing up in the 1950s and 60s. The 66-year-old retired marketing executive spent her childhood in North St. Louis.
I'm proud to say I'm from North St. Louis. I am not proud that we were part of the white flight, and that I wish that white people weren't afraid and didn't move.
But, of course, many white people did move out of their city neighborhoods, just as Black residents began to move into those neighborhoods.
And in addition to a host of other things, redlining, restrictive deed covenants, fear-mongering among both governments and the real estate industry, white flight is a big reason St. Louis looks the way it does now.
So I'm not proud from that standpoint. But again, underlying that is a sense of racism and classism, right? Because of the way our urban development happened here.
On today's episode, we're not focusing so much on the policies that literally mapped out who lives where in the city. We're instead going to get close to the people affected by them.
And we're going to do that by telling you Christine's story about the scars of segregation in the city that she loves and her own family's role in that segregation.
And how art created by a young Black woman who grew up in the same area a generation later has helped Christine deal with it all.
I feel like it's a time now for reflection and more honesty.
From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here, a show for people somewhere on the woke spectrum.
There's no better way to learn about a place than to have someone give you a personal tour. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
Yeah, so that's what we asked Christine to do.
Yeah, she picked me up from the radio station on a sunny spring day after battling some rare St. Louis traffic.
I see you. I'm so sorry.
Oh, you're fine. Yeah.
We got into her car, and as I got myself settled, she fiddled with the radio.
You probably don't want to listen to NPR. You probably have enough of that.
Oh, goodness.
So the studio that Camille and I work in is just a couple of streets south of Christine's old neighborhood in North City.
Soon, we're on a street that was literally the center of her life as a kid.
So this was my life as Grand Avenue. Everything we did was about getting on the bus because we didn't have... My dad drove to work. My mom didn't drive, never drove. I didn't know anybody. Nobody back then had two cars.
It's hard to imagine that these days, especially as we roll over roads dotted by potholes, no doubt by thousands of cars that pass through each day.
So I was born in 1951, and we lived in North St. Louis until 1965. The house we lived in was built in 1905, and as I understand it, there was a housing boom after the World's Fair because all of the artisans were busy building for the World's Fair until 1904, right? So then 1905 they start building. That's when our house was built.
Back then, Christine says, anything you needed was in the neighborhood. The grocery store, the pharmacy, the schools, the churches.
There were lots of bars and taverns on almost every corner. There was a lot of drinking. Dad's drink and mom cooked dinner. Kind of was how it boiled too. And for us, we thought like we were the coolest of all because we lived across the street from the baseball stadium. Do you know where the stadium was? So it was on North Grand, on Grand here, between Sullivan and Dodier, and we lived on Sullivan. So we literally, in our bedroom window at night, the lights from the stadium would shine into our bedroom window. We could hear when there was a home run by the roar of the crowd. We would sneak into the stadium to see the Cardinals practice. Stan the Man Musial, you know, was on the team then. It was the stadium when the Cardinals won the World Series in 1964. And then the stadium moved and went to the downtown location.
When Christine was growing up, all the side streets were connected to Grand.
But 60 years later, many of them are either one-ways or closed off. So we have to take a windy road to her family's old house.
And there was a movie theater here at Grand and Natural Bridge. And that, of course, is Fairgrounds Park. Our childhood growing up was really somewhat magical.
It was also pretty much all white. After a few more turns, we make it to Sullivan Street. Christine parks her sedan across from a cream-colored brick house.
Now, as I remember this house, it was huge. Obviously, you can see it's not gigantic, but it seems huge, you know, when you're a kid.
At the end of the block, where a church now stands, there used to be an apartment building. Around the time she was in middle school, Christine says, black people started moving into the neighborhood.
I'm going to back up and say, this is just how I remember my childhood. I am not speaking for all white people, all white flight, or any of that. But as I recall it, you know, when we were about, when the neighborhood started to change, when there was this fear.
This would have been right around the time the civil rights movement was taking hold across the country, as African Americans were fighting for more social gains.
So we were raised during that time in church where you know the priest would say everybody's equal, color of skin doesn't matter, and that's absolutely what my mom said at home. That's how we were raised and what we were talked about until this whole thing about your property values came in. Suddenly, if black people moved in, your property values were going to go down. And if you didn't get out right away, the longer you waited, the more your property values dropped. And for my parents, they were the very first people in their family to own a house. And they could only own it because they owned it with my grandmother. My grandmother was a single mom back in the day. Right, and worked in sewing factories, and my mom had to stay at home alone with the shades pulled because some days she couldn't go to school because she didn't have enough bread for lunch and she was embarrassed. So it was tough. And then to be able to pool together to buy a house was a big flipping deal. So they had this house, and the thought of losing your home or losing the value of your home was really frightening.
On top of that, Christine says, there used to be all these myths about black people and how they lived. Crime would go up because black people moved into a neighborhood. Property values would go down because black people moved into a neighborhood.
There was also worries that black people would live like 10 people in one apartment.
Now, the irony of this is, kids in my grade school, like, I won't use people's name, but there was one family, they had 13 kids, they lived in four rooms. My best friend, her whole family lived in a four-family flat. They each had literally one really small room. They had four rooms. One was really a teeny little passageway room. And they had six people. So, you know, how much more population dense could you get?
Of course, this logic didn't matter.
The neighborhood began emptying out. Many white people went west.
Christine's family sold their home to a speculator and went south.
As I recall, and I could have these figures wrong, but as I recall, my parents ultimately sold the house for $9,000. And the house they bought cost $18,000 far away. And it was just devastating, financially devastating. My grandparents, who we so loved, I mean, my parents raised us, but they were part of our life so much. They moved to an apartment off of North Grand, and we moved to South County. And everybody started moving. And it was a devastating emotional time for all of us.
Christine was 14 at the time, so she was going through all the normal teenage stuff. So this was pretty intense. And moving meant she had to break up with her boyfriend.
You know, your first love. Remember that feeling? Well, we had to break up because what are you going to do? How are you going to have a boyfriend that you have to can't go see if you can't walk there? And the buses were impossible. It was not going to work. So it seemed so dramatic at the time.
Christine grew up, put herself through school, established a career, had kids, and a few years ago, opened her home to her nephew who went to a local university.
The family would often get into discussions about what her nephew was studying in class, and he was especially fascinated to learn the history of segregation, redlining, and white flight in St. Louis.
Christine says that's when it dawned on her that her own family had a very real part in that history of segregation.
And he's studying it in school. It's like first-person account right here at the kitchen table. And I really began to question and figure out who profited from this.
I'm not sure that there's a direct answer.
This is Colin Gordon. He's a professor at the University of Iowa.
Because I'm not sure that, it's entirely a sort of material question.
Gordon wrote the book about segregation in St. Louis. It's called Mapping Decline.
Certainly, homeowners and realtors who worked in North St. Louis fretted constantly about the spread of African-American occupancy. And many, as a result of their sort of, strong and prevailing assumptions about the relationship between African-American occupancy and property values, they lost money. The inability and the unwillingness to consider sort of stably integrated neighborhoods was destructive of property values for a lot of people, not just for African-Americans.
Colin says, sure, some people made a little money, but it really came down to motive and opportunity.
The motive certainly is the sort of prevailing wisdom that that mixed neighborhoods, as the realtors put it, were unsustainable. That neighborhoods should be all white or all black, and that if one lived in a mixed or transitional neighborhood, the value of your property was going to collapse. So there were certainly mid-century people didn't want to send their kids to schools with African-American children. They wanted all kinds of segregation of both housing and public services. The opportunity is provided by federal mortgage policies, which, in the late 1930s, early 1940s, bring homeownership into sight for a lot of working class families. But because these policies are laundered through local institutions and local realtors, they're available almost exclusively to white families. So, one way to think about it is simply to recognize that, the city, like a lot of cities of its age, had a deteriorating infrastructure. It had older houses that were closer together. It had, enormous stress on its tax base and on its schools. And lots of people in the city, black and white, wanted to leave for these suburban opportunities. White families were the only ones that were able to do so for a generation.
Now, we should note that Christine did read Colin Gordon's book, which is again named Mapping Decline, and it was part of her own sort of self-education process. But learning these things, the policies, didn't make understanding the human emotions any easier for Christine.
I guess I can say that after we left North St. Louis, I never felt like I belonged anywhere again for a long time. I lived, obviously, in other places, but I didn't feel like where I live was where I belonged. It just feels sad. It just feels sad. A lot of things changed when we moved. And our family life got tougher. Ultimately, my brother went to Vietnam. My sister married a black man in the 70s and then was a single mom of a biracial child in St. Louis in the 70s. She was a teenager. It was things just got rough in our life.
All these feelings, they've weighed heavily on Christine in the last few years, especially, she says, after the death of Michael Brown, and on a day-to-day basis.
Christine volunteers at a school, and her commute to that school takes her through her old neighborhood. And it's always a reminder to her about the long-term cost of segregation.
I'm not a person who likes to go back. I don't go back to my high school. I don't go back. So it just feels sad. And mainly now it feels sad because I feel like it's such a ridiculous waste. And that is the only reason I agreed to do this, because I'm all too painfully aware that you can manipulate this however you want to edit it. I did this for a living. I know what it's about. And I feel uncomfortable, honestly. But I feel like we have to stand up and say, the system is wrong. It's rigged against each other. And there is white privilege. That's the irony. I never believed I had white privilege. How would you think you were privileged in the world? You know, what could be worse than where we were? My parents and grandparents, they talked of stories of being union organizers, of being on the street, my mom with her mother and being homeless, all this stuff. And I put myself through college while I worked. But yeah, there is a privilege that comes just by the way you look when you walk in a room. And until we all talk about it and acknowledge it and recognize that this isn't somebody who's being deliberately mean or evil, it's just what is, and then stand up and say, it doesn't have to be. It's all artificial. We've let this happen, and we have to say no more.
A couple years ago, Christine heard something that gave her some solace. She and her nephew, the same one who was studying the history of segregation in college, went to a local TED Talk.
One of the speakers was a young Black woman from North St. Louis who wrote a poem about her experiences.
And the poet says she felt a sense of loss when she returned to a neighborhood vastly different than what she remembered as a kid.
And I remember her reading that poem, and I was thinking, those are my memories too.
It was obvious that this poem resonated a lot with Christine. She brought it up in almost every conversation I had with her. But what was this poem? Who wrote it?
Christine, she couldn't really remember. So we set out to find out for her.
So guess who I met up with yesterday?
I don't know.
The poet.
Did you really?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Finding the poet that Christine liked so much was not easy. After all, she didn't remember the name of the poet, let alone the name of the poem.
But there were a few clues to go on. The local TED Talk, the fact that the poet was a young Black woman, and that her work had something to do with memories. So we put in a few hours of work, and thanks to the magic of the internet and YouTube, we found her.
My name is Shiraz Gorman.
Shiraz grew up in College Hill. It's a neighborhood close to where Christine grew up in North St. Louis.
The territory name, when you want to talk about, you know, street economies and stuff like that, they call it the Dub. And I don't know when it got coined, the Dub. But, yeah, that's probably like late 90s, something like that, early 2000s.
The two women grew up a generation apart, but their feelings about North St. Louis are almost echoes of each other.
This was totally clear when we met up with Shiraz in the middle of the street where she grew up in North St. Louis.
This is the house I grew up in.
Right here?
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
My cousins still live here.
Shiraz's family got to College Hill around the same time families like Christine's were fleeing St. Louis.
My grandmother bought that house in 1969. It was a primarily white neighborhood. I think it was kind of the start of the white flight. But yeah, my mother and them have stories for days about how that house was egged and just horrible stuff, getting said, you know, to the family for moving in and, you know, but we're still here.
As we stand on the sidewalk and look across to her family's yard, Shiraz slowly shakes her head.
Because, she says, there's so much missing. So many homes gone, replaced with what look like many fields.
It just trips me out, like the families that used to be there and everything. And yeah, on the corner, because yeah, that's Prairie. On the corner of Prairie and Florissant used to be a mini mansion. Gone.
Also gone, the corner store, the cleaners. Like Christine, Shiraz remembers a neighborhood that was self-sufficient when she was a kid. Everything was in walking distance.
Our block was stable. Next to Jesse Wise, you had the Flemings. Next to the Flemings, you had my homegirl Lavonda. Like her family who had been there forever. Just old school, loving black people who cared about the children and would quickly walk across the street. So my mother in them house, if I acted up, Lord forbid, this was one of those neighborhoods. Like if you got in trouble in school, and if my mother wasn't home yet, my godmother would get me first.
This village mentality, it's what Shiraz loved about her old neighborhood. And like Christine's experience, it was filled with people who looked like her.
Though there were a few whites who stayed. Shiraz says one of them, a man named Charlie Mueller, was almost like another uncle.
The whole thing of being white and black and that being a tense relationship or contentious was didn't even compute to me as a kid. And plus, my Aunt Diane, who was my Aunt Velma's best friend when I was growing up, who then wound up marrying my uncle, my cousin Jeffrey, was a white woman, and her daughters, you know, Danny and them used to come down here. Crystal, her other daughter, was mixed race. But I mean, it was just that tension didn't even exist on this block or in the neighborhood, you know, while I was growing up. But those were the only two, you know, non-black people who lived in the neighborhood that I got to know intimately. And it wasn't even a bad thing that it turned over and was like all black people. Because like I said, it was pretty much working class black folk, like postal worker, factory, auto plant. Shoot, my cousin's a school teacher. You know, my Aunt Cookie she was a journeyman. She was a bricklayer. So, I mean, you had that in the neighborhood. So I would definitely say it was closer late 80s, early 90s to when things start turning, where you could see the effects of the underground drug economy, like, ticking up. And things start feeling a bit unsafe, and you know, next thing you know, this became Crip territory. Across Grand became Blood territory, and the drive-bys start happening. And cats who I was growing up with all of a sudden start becoming doughboys. You know, it was like, and these were like just regular young guys, you know, we were all in middle school and high school together, and just that turn happened, and they went their path, and next thing you know, just a lot of friends start getting shot and killed or injured, you know. So, yeah.
Shiraz grew up. She went to college, moved away, built a career in advertising. She'd come back to St. Louis from time to time, and it was during one of those visits that she wrote the poem Christine would eventually hear at her TED Talk.
I asked Shiraz to recite the poem as we toured her neighborhood.
Who moved my memories? Put them in flames, hosed them down, separated what held them together. Sold them to... Wait, let me start over. Oof. Who moved my memories? Put them in flames, hosed them down, separated what held them together. Sold them a one. Oh, Lord. My apologies. Let me just shake this because it just really like hit me like I'm standing in front of like two places that are gone that meant a lot to me. So it just almost got choked up. I was just like, ah, okay. Let me shake that off. Whew.
Have you read it over here before?
Nope, first time ever. It's so funny because I always wanted to do like a reading in my old neighborhood. Like when I worked in advertising, I would fly home and I would like do focus groups on the stairs, you know, just campaigns I was working on and stuff like that. So, yeah, but never in my book. Who moved my memories? Put them in flames, hosed them down, separated what held them together, sold them away to someone willing to pay a premium, buried them underneath my feet, stuffed them somewhere I can't see, made them look like something I don't know. Who knows why folks want to erase things? I see whole neighborhoods blighted by some sort of entity. Had it ever thought to stop and think about how we might feel? Or does it even know we exist? Or maybe it knows and wants to act like we don't. Wrapped us up in some sort of derogatory subhuman ghetto myth. Maybe it's fine with our ghost. Lost around this place we once remember, just trying to find home, not attempting to haunt anything. But we can't find what we recall, what feels like yesterday. Those places that made us smile and have our laughter, sorrow, happiness, histories, our histories trapped somewhere in them. Where is this love I'm holding on to? Who moved it and why? Perhaps those government notes that instruct us on who to trust takes precedence over a culture, a history, a people, an ethic, over love and its preservation. Now, should I be mad? Because change is the natural order of things, and it was never promised to be palatable, easy to swallow like the first kiss I remember but can't feel no more. But it was real. Yes, it is real. Home is real. What is missing once was and still is real. Who knows why folks want to act like we are not? Who am I now without these places I remember? Without my memories but in my head, and even that's foggy at times. Because there's nothing to show for what I know, because I know what I know, but who else besides me knows it was real, is real, to me and to the people who lived, loved, yes, loved, laughed, worked, rested, watched each other's children cross the street, borrow a cup of sugar, knew family secrets and could tell you when you got old enough to bear the truth, cut your grass because they felt like it. Knew to check on you when the summers had a pinch of hell in it. The people, these people, what happened to the people in this place? Who stopped caring about the people? But I have eyes that see. I see the dividing lines, they aren't imaginary. I see what stands and what goes, what's abandoned and what's adorned, what opens up and what closes down, what gets watered and what we allow to rot. I feel the old history limping its way around. I hear its old thoughts sprouting out of new mouths, coded language decoded in the blink of an eye and ample silence. Where did it all come from? This old ghost with his wrecking ball of a way, let me ask you something, ghost. Why are you laying it all to waste? Don't you know nothing new can replace what has been, because what was priceless. See, I got eyes that see ghost. They see what once was beautiful being just that, beautiful. Yet I see people trying not to see. And it's all visible if they care to look. So take your blinders off because it's all being seen. See the city, histories torn down, stolen from where they used to stand. Sold like they, like we. Never mattered, like we somehow were never precious enough. With our memories buried somewhere beneath, in a city that appears not to see all histories as equal, tell me if we can't find something, something that looks like our memories, something that feels like home, how are we to move forward?
Mm-hmm.
I'm amazed how many times I almost cried during this. Because it's home. You just can't take people's memories away. You know what I'm saying? There's something really blasphemous about taking away things that are precious to people. And I think people don't realize how precious buildings are and environments are and the memories that come to mind and, you know, the things that happened, you know? Yeah. At least I have that, you know?
We told Shiraz about Christine, how much the poem meant to her, and how she's been trying to reconcile her family's role in white flight that just reinforced segregation here in St. Louis. And we asked the poet to answer one of Christine's main questions.
What do you think would have happened if people hadn't been afraid? In your grandmother's time, in her time, later on, now?
I'll just go back to it. With memories. You would have had some great memories. Would have had some great friends who would have became adopted family members, like how Charlie Mueller was to our family and into my life, you know? So I think that's what people miss out, you know, with. It's like, yeah, you could have missed out on some real, you missed out possibly on some really meaningful connections and having your worldview changed, you know? I didn't grow up with stereotypes thinking that somehow white people were better than black people. We all lived on the same block, you know? We went to the same church. Went to the Catholic church right up here. Went to Holy Name on Grand and Emily, you know? So it's like, yeah, your worldview would have been changed and challenged and quite possibly, you know, had the possibility to walk in this world a little more whole and a lot less ignorant of other people, you know, and people's ways of life. And in behaving, and probably would have been able to humanize each other versus allowing the television to dictate, you know, what you believe about folks and how crime-ridden, you know, this area was supposedly, you know. It eventually got that way. But I mean, that's what economic disparity and poverty does. That's what redlining does. It brings in, it allows the space for a certain element. Just didn't get that way. Just didn't start out that way. And guess what? There was crime here when there were white people here. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, there were drugs here when there were white people here. You know, so I think that's the thing that, you know, would have been challenged and changed for her. Just quite possibly would have walked through the world a lot more whole and understanding, and to really see we all people. Yeah, we have our cultural differences, of course, you know. But at the end of the day, when you all see each other on a Saturday morning and Sunday morning out planting flowers, cleaning your yard, blasting music, sharing food and everything else. That's what it was. Because at the end of the day, everybody just wanted to be happy.
We Live Here is produced by me, Tim Lloyd.
And me, Camille Stanley.
Sheila Newman is the executive editor of St. Louis Public Radio.
And from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.